like a Hellcat.
Hello, and welcome to the fifth installment of my series of lectures on John Gardner's On Moral Fiction. I am Matthew McGebna, host of The Ink Drop, a general interest podcast focused around art and writing and all of the ways in which it intersects. If you haven't listened to the first four episodes, you're free to go back and listen to those. In those chapters, Gardner lays out some of the parameters of what he considers moral art, moral fiction. We understand at this point in the book, he doesn't clearly mean moral in the Judeo-Christian or the Orthodox sense. Now he gets into some specific examples from his time. We'll go into that a little bit. Remember, this book was published in the late 1970s. And this episode is looking at chapter 5, which is the final chapter of part 1 of the book, which is titled Premises on Art and Morality. On page 74, John Gardner starts by saying, "Too often we find in contemporary fiction not true morality, which requires sympathy and responsible judgment, but some fierce ethic, which under closer inspection turns out to be some parochial group's manners and habitual prejudices elevated to the status of ethical imperatives, axioms for which bigotry or hate, not love, is the premise. Nothing about the present situation in the arts is more curious than the fact that unjust writers are quite regularly praised, whether they write in old-fashioned form, as Harry Cruse does, or in more innovative form. Consider Robert Coover's much anthologized short story, A Pedestrian Accident." So, in Robert Coover's story, A Young Man's Pedestrian Accident, he references a young man's run over by a truck, and a crowd of callous and nosy onlookers begin to gather around the young man, gather around his dying body as he's dying in the streets. Nobody calls the cops or an ambulance. The characters actually begin to air their side concerns while they're standing around him. One woman takes advantage of the young man's inability to speak to tell the crowd that the two of them were engaged in a sexual relationship. Meanwhile, the truck driver tries to move his vehicle and runs the young man over again in the process, an attempt at some sort of comic relief. The police officer who tries to help is incompetent. The doctor who has the ability to help does nothing. And the man that everyone thought was a priest actually turns out to be a homeless man waiting for the man to die so he can take his clothes. The whole story, according to Gardner, is sent up to be funny, you know, comedic, but it isn't. It's dark and it's pessimistic, and it celebrates the worst in human instincts. And it's intended in some ways to poke fun of the Christian value of hope. It's cruel, and it sends up the end of a young man to be an allegory for the crucifixion. The young man, Paul, waits for death, lying in the road, arms akimbo, to sort of symbolize Christ on the cross. We all know stories like this, penned probably since the 1970s, that aimed to enrage or provoke conservative Christian readers. You know, that kind of fun thing to do, to poke a Christian in the eye. Maybe it stems from the Viking tradition. I don't know. The moral fiber of these stories are intended to espouse a worldview of hopelessness and anger. And this is the problem that Gardner has with it. In the story, Paul asserts, quote, "There's nobody out there." And that sets the world right again after he utters this in the story, at least the world of the story. "There's nobody out there," he says, and that realization somehow liberates him. And the story is obviously Coover's rejection of the Christian answer to the universe, and that's fine, okay. But does anybody really see the world this way? Does any writer who places characters on the scenery and has them carry out acts of cruelty and hopelessness and absurdity without somehow offering a way it ought to be, are they really leading their readers in a serious way towards how to live? This was my principal problem with The Unnamed, a book by Joshua Ferris. Ferris burst onto the literary scene as a young man with a stunning debut novel, a beautiful novel, albeit about 100 pages too long. It was called And Then We Came to the End. And that novel really does a fascinating job of capturing the cultural zeitgeist of our time through the lens of an advertising agency, the way that Mad Men did for the 1960s and 70s. It's like a serious literary version of The Office. But and the novel was a huge success, but he followed up that career-making debut with The Unnamed, which is a story about a successful family man who develops a psychological condition where he catatonically wanders off on foot and disappears for months from his family, even years at a time. And every so often, this protagonist remembers himself and where he came from, and he finds his way back home, only to leave again when the next attack takes over. The next impulse drives him. He has a wife. He has a teenage daughter. They both do their best in the novel to work through his illness. They try to keep tabs on him. But lo and behold, every time he just compulsively gets up, walks out of the house, and isn't heard from again for a long stretch of time. Now, there are real moments of beauty and heartbreaking writing in that book. Right, so it's not necessarily a dig on the book itself, right? But the ending reminds me a little of what Gardner's talking about here with Coover's story, Coover's ending to a pedestrian accident. We exit Ferris's world with a nothing out there sort of nihilism. His protagonist wanders off in the winter, and Blaine, I should probably give you a spoiler alert if you haven't read the book. Just pause the video and go read the book and then come right back and unpause. So I'm going to spoil a little bit. He wanders off in the winter, and he freezes to death. We presume he freezes to death on the last pages of the novel. We stay with him until the end. The reader stays with him all the way to the end, freezing in a tent, despite the existence of a loving family just a phone call away, clinging to the small mundane pleasures of the corporeal, right? Drinking a sip of water. So there's this image of him sort of sipping at the water as he's dying, and he knows he's dying. And there's just nothing he really intends to do about it. And this is where many people might get the sense that Gardner is implying that all art should reinforce Christian values and ideas. But that's not quite it. In this chapter, he does quite a bit stand up for Christianity, I guess I would say. Particularly in this section where he talks about Coover and a pedestrian accident as sort of a send-up of Christianity. So he stands in defense of it, but it's not quite it. It's not quite what Gardner's getting at. He is reacting to the sort of en vogue, fashionable, quasi-edgy, in the 70s, probably more edgy than now, but definitely not edgy anymore, manipulation of artists who seem to create art for the purpose of lampooning Christianity or the existence of God, right? And we know it when we see it. Many of us celebrate it anyway. Right, but it's not particularly daring, at least not anymore. But it's not so much the problem here is about an artist's particular rejection of Christianity, a particular artist's particular rejection of any religion, as it is about the backbone of Christian ethos, which is the concept of love. Right, that love is a large, massive, powerful driving force that motivates us and gives us hope. We hope because we love. We make effort because we love, right? Art that is loveless has nothing really to offer but propaganda. Fashionable things that aren't so, right? Which is what he said in chapter 4. Fashionable things that aren't so. Gardner says, if we're unable to distinguish between true morality, life-affirming, just and compassionate behavior, and statistics, the fact that we all die someday, or worse, trivial moral fashion, we begin to doubt morality itself. And this is how it becomes possible for Norman Mailer to Charles Manson to say that Charles Manson was intellectually courageous, right? And Gardner puts that in quotes, that Mailer had attributed a moral courage or an intellectual courage to Charles Manson. Because Manson is is intellectually courageous when the pursuit of truth is the pursuit of some popular charismatic whim? Well, because the sky is unguarded, right? The sky is unguarded, so let's create our own gods out of some pretentious fabric. And that paves the way for somebody to look at somebody like Charles Manson and as if he's some sort of prophet or intellectually courageous person because of his antisocial ethos. Now, because the critic hasn't been doing his job heralding the artists who pursue moral art, we now have a society where truth is whim and morality is more about aesthetics and intellectual parlor tricks. In this new world, Gardner says the decent artists, and most artists are decent people, right? When you speak to them, when you interact with them, when you read their interviews, when you break bread with them, right? Decent artists will then manifest their pursuits into two directions, and both of them are not particularly fruitful. One avenue they'll pursue maybe is they'll pay careful attention to whatever pressing or sometimes passing issue is bothering our world at the moment. Something like social justice, for example, and then make that the sole aim of their characters or the sole motivation. And this is actually in Gardner's book. I'm not editorializing on that. He talks about social justice a little bit and its values and where social justice need not or should not apply in that phrasing, right? So that's one thing that the writer does, right? Having their characters pursue some sort of social justice and make it the sole aim, their sole motivation. Or the second thing they might do, writers will view themselves merely as cold historians holding a mirror up to humanity rather than what they are, which is a torch to light the way out. Now, what does that mean? Because both have their value. And I think you'd be hard-pressed to find an author in 2022 who isn't almost pathologically obsessed with making some sort of plea for social justice of some sort. And as far as holding a mirror up, even historical fiction is designed to get us to recognize ourselves and the commonalities that bridge the generations of the world. Now, isn't that cool? We would be second-rate artists if our characters didn't draw realistic impressions from real people. Good. So what's wrong with that, right? We know that we want our artists to speak on matters of social justice, and we know that we want our artists also to hold a mirror up. So what's the problem? Well, the problem, as Gardner sees it, is that it pales in comparison with the artist's true calling to pursue the lead and lead, right? Pursue and lead, which sounds like a contradiction, right? The way in celebration of the permanently moral ideas that our story has always aimed to provide. Think Little Red Riding Hood, which we talked about, right? The other two concerns are great, but they lose force over the decades. It's a distinction between the artist who goes for the clever rather than the profound. Gardner, in the chapter here, spends a good deal of time focusing on Donald Barthelme, the late novelist of the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Barthelme was a much celebrated postmodernist author with undoubted talent, but Gardner really took exceptions to the way he seemed to find the clever way out of stories rather than to dream up large goals for humanity. He looked for the clever way out, because he's interested in his own kinks and in offering up nothing more than a gaze at the genius of his own mind. I think they call it getting high on your own supply. Othello gets high on his own supply. Many writers do. I'm not particularly well-versed in Barthelme. I'm curious to know if you recognize some of this, though, in our own contemporary geniuses, quote-unquote, scare quotes. Think about the literary lions today. Who are the literary lions at the moment? And think about their fiction, right? Do their characters lead the way? Are their books dreaming up large goals for humanity? Or has fiction kind of shrunk into such a personal space that you can fit it into a bedroom? A moral art, at its best, holds up models of virtue. Now that's strange. This is what we mean when we analyze the varying archetypes of the hero, the reluctant hero, the superhero, the anti-hero, the accidental hero, which is really no accident at all, the accidental hero. What makes these characters moral, despite how they got to the scenery we built, is that they're all heroes, right, from pre-Greek origins that likely meant defender or protector, right? That word hero. But defender of what? Protector of what? Well, think about the book. Protectors of the wall between order and chaos. Protectors of the organizing forces that uphold humanity and guide human civilization. Frodo beats back the forces of darkness so that mankind can continue, much the way John Henry sacrifices his life to beat back the cold and uncaring of technological progress, right? John Henry, if you don't know, it's that old American folklore, folktale. John Henry was a steel-driving man, a black hero, who was a steel-driving the railroad ties down, working on the Intercontinental Railroad, at a specific time in his life when automated steel driving was taking over the industry, putting a lot of people out of work, and how efficient was it? And so in the legend, in the folklore, John Henry challenges the mechanical steel driver to a race, basically, to a duel. Who could drive the steel the fastest? Who can get on up the mountain fastest? And John Henry has this race with this machine and defeats it. But in his defeat, he suffers a heart attack. He puts his hammer down and he dies. John Henry is a conservative by our standards. But what is he conserving or defending, right? What is he defending in that story? Why do we hear the story of John Henry? What is he defending? Our sense that mankind needs to feel needed. Now that's white hot, right? Our sense that mankind needs to feel needed. Even in his death, he proves to the crowd that's watching him as he's racing this machine, he proves to us, the collective, that there are limitations to technological progress. That there's a little bit of the devil in technological progress. There is something missing in the machinery of machinery. The steel-driving man shows the way for all steel-driving men. And he preserves for us the notion that, like, with work and productivity and employment comes stability and family and human camaraderie that nourishes the spirit, right? Something akin to that. Those are real values, right? Timeless, archetypal values. But many artists are falling under the influence of critics who would rather question whether any lasting values really exist. And this is an existential problem of our time in 2022. Many artists that are saying fashionable things that aren't true and full of self-doubt and guilt about privileges, and they're questioning their ability or even their responsibility to lead. Now, back to this question of love. Gardner says, for great art, even concern is not enough. Great art celebrates life's potential, offering a vision unmistakably rooted in love. Now, love is another one of those words, like morality, that tend to send intellectuals running for a thesaurus to change it because it's yicky and outdated. The way morality is associated with religion in general, and Christianity in particular, Christianity's stand-in, I should say, the neighborhood priest who always made you feel like you were going to hell any minute, to be even more particular than Christianity. Love is associated with terrible rom-coms and Hallmark cards, right? But without love and art, there can be no serious art. It is ever-present in just about every amazing work of literature we have. From the Iliad to Shakespeare to Toni Morrison, Colson Whitehead, Ulysses, Dubliners. Gardner says, Without love, we get the ice-cold intellectual style of most academics or the worst fiction in The New Yorker. Despite the labors of academic artists and those sophisticates who are embarrassed by emotion, it seems all but self-evident that it is for the pleasure of exercising our capacity to love that we pick up a book at all. Except in the classroom, where we read what is assigned or study compositions or paintings to pass a course, we read or listen to or look at works of art in the hope of experiencing our highest, most selfless emotion, either to reach a sublime communication with the maker of the work, sharing his affirmations as common lovers do, or to find in works of literature characters we love as we do real people. Ultimately, in fact, plot exists only to give the characters means of finding and revealing themselves, and setting only to give them a place to stand. As for thought, the element so quickly dismissed by Aristotle, it is simply what the characters say or would say if they were wiser and had our distance from their story. In art, morality and love are inextricably bound. We affirm what is good for the characters in particular and for humanity in general because we care. The artist who has no strong feeling about his characters, the artist who can feel passionate only about his words or ideas, has no urgent reason to think hard about the character's problems, the themes in his fiction. He imitates human gesture in the movements of his puppets, but he does not worry as a father worries about the behavior of his son, and the result is a fictional universe one would not want one's loved ones forced to inhabit. Gardner, as we notice in this first half of the book, is no fan of Norman Mailer. And in this section, he absolutely unloads on Mailer's fiction. We don't have to go too deep into that. If you want to read the book, you can. If you're a Mailer scholar, it might interest you what Gardner's problem was with Mailer. His principal problem with him is that he uses characters as stand-ins for his socio-political agenda. Now, therefore, you know, why are we in Vietnam? In that book, in Why Are We in Vietnam, a white character is interacting with a black character, and they're both allegorical pawns used to further Mailer's belief that our treatment of the Vietnamese is a direct consequence of our ill treatment of blacks in America. He has similar criticism of Vonnegut and Joseph Heller. So this is not to say that he necessarily even disagrees with Mailer's premises, right? Which could be white hot and brilliant. But more that his characters really feel like cardboard cutouts. They feel like stand-ins for the socio-political messages he wants to direct to his audience, right? He has similar criticism of those other authors as well. The author of Something Happened, in which Gardner, according to John Gardner, nothing happens. It's a pretty funny line. Joseph Heller's Nothing Happened. I actually have that on my shelf. I haven't cracked it open yet. Transcribers of the moods of their time. Now, how's that for a way to think about them, right? Transcribers of the moods of their time. How is that for a definition of the artist that we seem to herald even 40 years after the book came out, right? I mean, how often do you hear about an artist? She holds up a mirror to our world. As if that's all that's required of an artist. And even worse are those artists who bask in this sort of accolade and claim to be the new truth-tellers, right? And very often they take on this role, they take on the responsibility of focusing on the socio-political message the artist might be passionate about. The work suffers as a result because the writer can become somewhat indifferent to the characters, their lives, their emotional state when making choices in the novel. They take either no position or else smug, slogany positions, Gardner says. Right? Those writers take either no position or they take smug, slogany positions. Now, that's interesting because, well, if there's such thing as a post-postmodern time period, I think we're in it. Not that I want to add any more of these silly isms and is to the lexicon, all right? But there was a time when even Mailer's thoughts on Vietnam would have been considered heterodox, punk rock, right? And now they're slogans. Why is this character being treated this way? Sexism. Why is that character an underdog? Oppression. Right? The answers are slogany and predictable. They offer, if anything, canned cynicism or dramatic gimmickry, interesting and arresting infernal entertainment, but nothing that will hold, nothing that will help. Therefore, we meet in a work of fiction and sympathize with a suffering American worker laboring under the fat, sweaty palm of the grinning capitalist whom we're supposed to hate, whom we're told to hate by the artist, rather than the treatment of the suffering worker and the greedy capitalist as individuals who have been strapped to a different part of the suffering wheel and therefore allows us to see the moral search in both characters. Why not that? Now, this is very smugly dismissed as a form, at least in political circles and social media, this is kind of dismissed as a form of both sidesing nowadays. As if considering both sides of human experience a bad thing. The reader is frankly not given permission to explore the possibility that there might be multiple sides to suffering, to love, to arrogance, to wickedness, to virtue, to bravery, to cowardice, to treason, to loyalty. Any artist that attempts to both sides their art will meet the critic who's not doing their job, but doing the bidding of some pressing political need, which has nothing to do with art, which is the death knell of art as we know it, as far as I'm concerned, because the critic many times can forge the decisions of the artist, given enough time, given enough pressure. It's been handed down from the postmodern writers who were still gunslinging when he wrote this book. They were still out there about, and the critics were always out there searching for the newest postmodern writer. And it's been handed down to the writers that we have now. They have carried what was once a symptom to a full-blown illness and almost total loss of faith in how true art is supposed to work, right? We have lost faith in some ways into how true art is supposed to work. So we leave with this idea in our heads. Think about this for as we move forward to part two of Gardner's analysis in the book. How is true art supposed to work? Right? And there are a number of ways. One, true art clarifies life. Two, true art establishes models of human action. Models of human action. Three, true art casts multiple nets in an attempt to snag a better future. Four, true art carefully analyzes our right and wrong directions and choices. And five, true art celebrates and mourns. It does not rant, it doesn't sneer or giggle at death or the inevitability of death. It invents prayers and weapons. Well, meaning it forges hope. It gives us tools against the beast. It designs visions for what ought and doesn't just obsess with a mirror over what is. Now, having said that, it also doesn't make hope some act of religious conversion. Hope appears from the lightning, and sometimes it is the lightning. We need to stop excusing mediocre and downright pernicious art. Stop taking it for what it's worth. As we take our fast foods, our overpriced cars that are no good, the overpriced houses we spend all our lives fixing, our television programs, our schools thrown up like barricades in the way of young minds, our brainless fat religions, our poisonous air, our incredible cult of sports, and our ritual of fornicating with all pretty or even horse-faced strangers. We would not put up with the debauched king, but in a democracy, all of us are kings, and we praise debauchery as pluralism. This book is, of course, no condemnation of pluralism, but it is true that art is in one sense fascistic. It claims, on good authority, that some things are healthy for individuals in society and some things are not. Unlike the fascist in uniform, the artist never forces anyone to anything. He merely makes his case, the strongest case possible. He lights up the darkness with a lightning flash, protects his friends, the gods, that is, values, and all humanity without exception, and then moves on. And with that, Gardner finishes part one of Moral Fiction, the part one which is the premises on art and moral fiction. He moves then into part two, Principles of Art and Criticism. So stay tuned for the upcoming episodes. We're going to end it there. I'm going to get into my analysis of those ideas that he puts in part two, Principles of Art and Criticism. He starts out by making a case for the durability of moral art versus the sort of flash in the pan of trendy art. Hopefully you're enjoying this series. If you are, please leave me a review or a comment on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. I'm also going to be uploading some of these to YouTube. I'm Matthew McGevna, and this is The Ink Drop, and you take care.
Hellcat.